When I read this story in Genesis,
I picture a Western movie, rugged and vast landscapes, people trying to etch out a living on the frontier, the air full of danger and possibility, as people try to make it. Now, this could be because I ended up watching kind of a Western movie this week. It's almost an old movie now, 10 years old, called There Will Be Blood. Has anyone seen this movie? I should warn you, if I ever reference a movie, like, chances are it's going to be a tragedy. I tend to watch tragic movies. But let me tell you this story, because you may not be familiar with it. The story is about a man named Daniel Plainview. He's an oil man in the 20th century. Now, in the 20th century, riches look like buckets of black oil. To some people, they still look like riches today. And so when Daniel discovers that there's a family in the middle of nowhere sitting on an ocean of oil, he wants to buy it. So he goes and visits this family. He presents himself as a family man. He goes to his son, who's not really his son, and he doesn't tell them that they are sitting on oil. He says, "Oh, I'd love to buy your property because my son is sick and he needs the fresh air." He's hoping to buy it off them as cheaply as possible. This family sees this man as a gift from God, and so they're willing to sell it. Although they do have a son who's a preacher, he's not a great model of what a preacher should be, because he's also interested in pursuing wealth, and he knows the family is sitting on oil, so he kind of strikes a hard bargain, and he wants to make sure that the church will also benefit from this wealth, that the church will be given a place of prominence. And so Daniel's happy to go along if it helps him get what he wants. And then he goes to this town meeting, and he presents this vision of what oil could do to the community. He says new roads, agriculture, employment, education, these are just a few of the things we can offer you. And I assure you, ladies and gentlemen, that if we do find oil here, and I think there's a very great chance that we will, this community of yours will not only survive, it will flourish. Sounds appealing, doesn't it? This is kind of the narrative that we are often told, that through our own resourcefulness and self-determination, we can get wealthier, and to have riches is for a community to flourish. And we want that. We want that almost as much as we want love. Now, it's interesting that this movie gives this beautiful speech, but actually also exposes that this speech is a sales pitch, one that Daniel has used in other towns before, and that actually, in private, later on in the movie, Daniel confesses he's not particularly interested in whether a community flourishes or not, and in fact, he has this great need to succeed. He wants to be the only one that succeeds. And he's prepared to do whatever is necessary, which, as the movie unfolds, turns out to be dark things. It includes violence, death, accidental and otherwise, and sacrificing everything that he holds dear, even the one relationship that kind of looks like has meaning to him, he is willing to pay in order to have this dream of wealth. Daniel Plainview kind of reminds me of Laban, this figure that we're looking at in Genesis today. Laban, when we first meet him, way back in Genesis 24, is described this way. His sister, Rebecca, comes home all excited because she's met a servant from their relative. And the first thing the text says about Laban is this. He looked at her new nose ring and her new bracelets. He noticed the expensive gifts she was wearing. And then he welcomed the servant into his house, saying, "Come, come, you who are blessed by Yahweh." And the servant comes in and tells them these stories of how their relative, Abraham, has become wealthy. And you can almost see Laban storing this information in his head, remembering this. So when years and years later, Jacob appears, Rebekah's son, even though he looks a little bit disheveled, Laban presents himself as a family man and welcomes Jacob into his home and quickly gets him working. Now, in those days, flocks of sheep, that's what riches look like, and daughters. Laban has two daughters, which he uses as commodities. He gets them to compete against one another to set a harder bargain. And when he notices that Jacob prefers one daughter over the other, He says, well, you can have her
if you work for me for 7 years. It's a hard bargain, but Jacob agrees.
Yet on his wedding night, Jacob is defrauded as Laban gives him the wrong daughter. But he's like, oh, that's okay. I'll throw in the other one too. You can get two for the price of another 7 years of labor. And Jacob agrees. After 14 years paying off this debt, Jacob is ready to go home with his family. So he goes to Laban, Genesis 30, 25, and says, send me on my way so I can go back to my own homeland. Give me my wives and children for whom I have served you, and I'll be on my way. You know how much work I've done for you.
Laban agrees that having Jacob around has made a difference. After 14 years, he looks around and he discovers that he has become quite wealthy. And so he seeks to work out why is he wealthy, and he engages in divination. Now, divination was quite common in the ancient world. There's lots of different ways you could kind of define. You're trying to like discern secret knowledge or knowledge about the future. It's probable that he went to his household gods, maybe consulted them, looked for omens. We still do a little bit of divination today. Sometimes it feels like people who look at stock markets are trying to divine the future, look for patterns that will help predict what's going to happen next. A lot of people are starting to put like crystals in their workplace because they believe will give them good energy, help them have success. Or you know, tarot reading is really popular, going and getting your fortune. We would like to know the future, and so we would do whatever works. And that's Laban. Laban does whatever works. Now, interestingly, what comes out of this divination process is this realization that it is because Jacob's God, Yahweh, is with him that Laban has experienced prosperity. Now, this shouldn't surprise us, especially if we've been in Genesis, if you've been with me for a while through Genesis, because we know that Yahweh has made a commitment first to Abraham, then to Isaac, then to Jacob. Yahweh has made a series of promises, promising them descendants, promising them children, and through them, this family is going to bless all the families on the earth. Laban experiences a taste of what that blessing looks like. Laban experiences grace. And what is his response? His response is to want to control it, own it, manipulate it, keep it forever. So he thinks he has to keep Jacob with him. So he goes to Jacob and he starts to haggle. And he says, verse 28, name your wages and I will pay. Jacob is also aware that Laban has greatly benefited from his hard labor and by Yahweh being there. But Jacob hasn't experienced much of this wealth. In fact, Jacob feels like his uncle has exploited him. And he's an outsider in the community. There's not many people who are going to defend him. Ancient Jewish rabbis, often in actually the Passover ceremony, will reference this story because they see in Laban almost a prototype, a prefigure of Pharaoh, the one who will end up enslaving the whole nation of Israel, which God will have to rescue. Individuals, nations, today we'd say corporations, who are involved in exploiting their workers are regularly judged by God in the Bible. God often ends up to be on the side of the poor and the weak. And it's worth checking in every now and then to figure out what side we are on. Wealth is not to be earned through exploitation. On Monday, there was data released saying that migrant workers in Australia, about one third of them, are getting paid less than $12 an hour, which is already half the minimum casual wage. It's happening in our country. If we can, we are just as likely to be Laban. And if we can rip someone off, we will. I mean, the other big discussion this year has been the fact that women are still getting paid less than men for the same work. As a church, we've watched the film True Cost. We are aware that slavery is still a huge issue in our world. So part of the role of the church and as individual Christians in our workplaces is where we have opportunity to ensure that people are being paid fairly for the work that they do.
And the church, unlike in the movie There Will Be Blood, the church is not to be complicit in this. It's very easy for the church also to be drawn into the same narratives that our world is telling us and to want wealth and be prepared to look the other way. But we are called to be different. We worship a God who is deeply opposed to this. Jacob, trusting that Yahweh is with him, says in Genesis 30, 31, "Don't give me anything, just do this one thing, and I'll continue to tend and watch over your flocks. Let me inspect your flocks today and remove all the sheep and goats that are speckled or spotted, along with all the black sheep. Give these to me as my wages." Jacob asks for the speckled and spotted and black sheep because he wants to have his own little flock. And he says, look, it'll be easy this way. Everyone will be able to tell which sheep belongs to which person. It will be all above board. There'll be no opportunity for stealing. It'll be fair. In fact, it's more than fair. Actually, it benefits, or it should benefit, Laban because sheep tend to be white. So Jacob's taking the minority. Laban agrees to the deal. But there's one thing we know about Laban, is that he's a good businessman. And so he's always looking for a loophole. Almost immediately after he makes this deal, he like runs off to his sons and tells his sons to remove all the speckled and spotted and black sheep and take them away. Take them far away from Jacob. Make sure there's a 3-day distance between them and Jacob. And then Jacob does something really unusual. It almost seems like Jacob is engaging in some trickery, although it's almost comedic. Jacob starts running around, pulling branches off trees and then stripping the bark of these branches so that it begins to look speckled and spotted, so you can see the white undersides of the branches. And then he sticks these branches around a watering trough where the sheep go to drink. And somehow, when they go to drink or when they go to mate, they are going to see these speckled branches and have speckled and spotted babies. I don't know that much about biology, but I don't think that's how it works. Why is Jacob doing something so crazy? Well, some people have said maybe Jacob is engaging in some magical folklore. And one scholar I read said that maybe Jacob is actually a genius. And actually, there's maybe some proof that if sheep look at speckled branches, it could cause an epigenetic change in their bodies. I don't know. But I don't think that's the main point. I think the main point is that this is really bizarre. It shouldn't work. And yet it does. Jacob begins to have his own flock. And this kind of frustrates Laban. So every year he tries to cheat Jacob and change the deal. He says, okay, this year it's only going to be the speckled crop flock you can have. And then they start to breed. Well, it's like, no, scratch that. This year you can only have the black sheep. It doesn't matter what Laban says, though, because Jacob's flock keeps increasing and Laban's flock decreases. And after 6 years of this, Laban is pretty unhappy, and so are his sons. They feel like they're being ripped off. They feel like Jacob is stealing their wealth. They feel like he has to be stopped. This dream that Laban had of growing wealthy seems to be slipping through his fingers. And at this point, Jacob decides, well, I think it's time for me to leave. I really need to get out of here now. So he gets Leah and Rachel together, his wives, out in the field where no one can hear them. And he says, look, I think we need to leave. And he tells them about this dream he's had. Now, dreams play a significant role in Jacob's life because once again, a God speaks to him in a dream. An angel of God appears and says, Genesis 31, verse 1. Look up and you'll see that only the streaked, speckled and spotted males are mating with the females of your flock. For I've seen how Laban has treated you. I am the God who appeared to you at Bethel, the place where you anointed the pillar of stone and made your vow to me. Now get ready and leave this country and return to the land of your birth. Suddenly Jacob's actions make a little bit more sense. God, in this instance, is deeply involved in this sheep breeding. It is God who is against Laban, not Jacob. Why? Because God has seen what Laban has done. Yahweh is not some little household god that you carry around, make your offerings to, and expect the reward.
Yahweh cannot be controlled like that. In fact, Yahweh responds. And one of the things that makes Yahweh respond are cries of injustice.
Jacob doesn't have to convince Leah and Rachel of this either. I mean, they know their father. They've experienced injustice from him firsthand. They say, and for the first time, they are united in this. We know. He sold us. He sold us, got some money off us, and now has spent it and wants to try and get our inheritance as well. Our father has treated us more like strangers than actual family. They're on board.
God hears and responds to the cries of injustice, whether that's big structural injustices or the injustices we might experience at work. God can and will respond.
Well, Jacob and his family pack up their things as quickly and as quietly as they can. Rachel grabs her father's household gods and they flee. They get a 3-day head start. But remember, this family has lots of children, so they move slowly. And when Laban hears, it doesn't take him too long to make up the difference. He wants blood. He is furious. He wants to destroy Jacob. But just before he gets to Jacob, God, for a second time, intervenes and speaks to Laban, this time in a dream. And he says, verse 24, "Be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad." I think if God had not spoken, this story would have ended in tragedy. And it can't end in tragedy because Jacob carries all the promises. If Jacob dies, how will there be blessing and grace for the families of this world? Laban, having encountered God, approaches Jacob a little more cautiously. And he plays this real family man. He says, "Jacob, why did you leave so quickly? Why did you sneak off? I would have thrown you a farewell party. I didn't even get to say goodbye to my grandkids. And where are my household idols? Where have you placed them, Jacob?" And Jacob says, "I ran off because I was afraid you wouldn't let me leave, that you'd take my family away from me. And as for your household gods, I haven't seen them. Search the camp. If you find them, kill that person." Now, this is a little bit tense because we know that Rachel has them. Rachel is Jacob's beloved wife, but Jacob doesn't know that. And so Laban searches the camp. Why does Rachel take these household gods? Again, there's lots of speculation, but I think she took them because she knew that they meant a lot to her father. They almost symbolize his obsession with wealth. It was the heir of the family who would receive the household gods. They were passed down through the generations. Rachel never stood a chance of getting them. She was a daughter. Daughters were cut out of the inheritance. And maybe she took them because she knew that that would break her father's heart more than his daughter's leaving. Well, Rachel happens to be sitting in her saddle and the household gods are tucked away there. And when her father asks for her to get down, again, there's this comedic touch here. She says, "I can't. I'm sorry, Dad, I have my period." And that makes him back away pretty quickly. And so he doesn't investigate and he never finds the idols. And so instead, he settles down with Jacob and they renegotiate. And again, Jacob reiterates how hard it has been to work for this man. For 20 years, he has worked for him under extreme conditions. In sweltering hot days and freezing nights, he has spent a lot of time away from his family. And he says, verse 44, "If the God of my father, the God of Abraham and the fear of Isaac had not been with me, he would surely have sent me away empty-handed. But God has seen my hardship and the toil of my hands, and last night he rebuked you." Laban looks at the world and thinks, "It all belongs to me. Those sheep, they're mine. Those daughters, they are mine." But in the end, he loses it. They make one last contract, another covenant, and Jacob promises to look after his daughters and grandchildren. And then they build this like boundary marker out of stones, because we know Jacob likes stones.
and they promise not to cross this boundary marker. Laban won't hurt Jacob, Jacob won't hurt Laban. Laban says goodbye to his family and then leaves. I don't know if he feels sad as he leaves, but I feel sad for him because he will never see any of his grandchildren or daughters again. This is a man who got a glimpse, a taste of grace, and I think squandered it, abused it. And this makes me sad because I think this is still possible today, but it's not a decision we make overnight. It's a lot of little decisions about what we think really matters. Too often we think that riches are the money we have in our bank accounts, and we're prepared to make sacrifices for that. I have seen people who have worked such long hours that they've sacrificed their families, they lose their families because they chose wealth or their jobs over their families. I've seen people make unethical decisions in their business, sacrificing their relationship with God and losing grace. In this story, we see a taste of what happens when God gets involved. We see the upside down kingdom. When the first should be last and the last should be first, where it's the poor who are blessed. That is what Jesus will teach. In fact, Jesus will go even stronger and he will critique the idea that wealth automatically means blessing. That's what the ancient world assumed. That's what we can assume today. Wealth can be a blessing, but it is not necessarily a blessing. And in fact, Jesus warns his disciples to be careful not to end up pursuing wealth. In fact, he says, store treasures in heaven rather than treasures on earth. In Matthew 6:24, he says, no one can serve two masters. Either you'll hate the one and love the other, or you'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. Jesus offers us another, richer way to live. Rather than scheming and deceiving and manipulating and seeing each other as competitors, which we need to cut down, God becomes weak, becomes one of us, lives simply, and calls people into relationship. Jesus sacrifices his life not for wealth, but for us, so that we might be set free to live another way, a way marked by generosity, a way where we bless others and make sure that those around us, particularly those most vulnerable, are treated fairly. Jesus calls people to gather around a simple meal, bread and wine, and remember and commit to this way. And that is what we're going to do today as we remember and celebrate communion.